This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
Meet and Three is back. We're kicking off our fourth season and celebrating HRN's 10th anniversary with a very special episode about our home, Brooklyn.
Roberta's was such an interesting place with such a strong gravitational pull. It attracted all these different groups.
The neighborhood has changed a lot over the past decade, from its culinary renaissance to the complicated implications of gentrification.
I would say the majority of the people who are members of our co-op definitely have a certain purchasing power, are mostly white, and we are trying to change that.
We're taking you on a journey that spans the birthplace of food radio to buzzy neighborhood pollinators to the transformative health journey of our borough president.
That was my moment of, you know, wow, someone has thrown me a life raft and I'm going to take it.
Subscribe to Meet and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey guys, it's May 21st, 2019. I'm Jimmy Carboni, the host of Beer Sessions Radio. We're here at heritageradionetwork.org. It's in our 10th season, so we got a great show tonight. We've been talking about all things local, craft beer, New York State, and beyond. And it seems that we think about local beer, but actually a big market for our beers is export, which is similar to many other industries that we think of in terms of business. And we've had a great guest on before, Kurban and Peter.
How Kurban.
Are you guys? Kurban.
How are you?
From Crafted Exports. We put together an interesting show about, exporting beer to Europe. And, so welcome to the show, Kurban.
Great to be here, as always.
Q. But just tell us your backstory, because it's pretty interesting. We think about everything that's happened in New York and craft beer. We forget that breweries like Brooklyn Brewery long ago were selling more beer exported than they were in New York.
Yes, export is growing. It's the reason that Peter and I started this company. I'm the co-founder, Peter, the other co-founder. And you and I were at a bar a couple weeks ago talking about the rise of craft internationally, and it kind of pivoted to specifics. And I spent Q1 living out of London, and I got to spend a lot of time with Mondo Brewing Co., Tom and Todd, the owners there. And we started kicking around the ideas, Todd and me specifically, about the Yanks and Sox are playing later this year in London, first time. And we came up with the idea of we should really do something along the lines of a New York versus Boston beer series, collaboration series. So the guys from Mondo, after the CBC this year, flew over, and two of our best New York breweries, Captain Lawrence and Gun Hill, who are here with us, we did them, and then also Harpoon and Night Shift out of Boston, and Mondo brewed with each of them, and those beers are currently on the water over. And we've partnered with a bunch of great accounts in London, Mother Kelly specifically, that's going to be pouring all the beer. So it's just another chapter in Crafted, another chapter in the rise of craft overseas.
Oh, it's exciting. And everybody introduce themselves. Keith?
Yeah, Keith from Captain Lawrence, the director of sales. Very happy to be here and very happy to be talking about export with Crafted.
Dave Lopez from Gun Hill, co-managing partner.
Kelly from Kelso, owner.
All right. Peter?
Peter McNulty, founder and logistics lead at Crafted Exports.
And then Kurban Walia.
Kurban. So we had you guys on over a year ago. We started talking about crafted exports and what you guys are doing. It is exciting, this the story of baseball in London. I think we just cut to that as you started, Kurban. Guys, Dave and Keith, so you had, tell us about the collaborations that happened. Let's this big picture. So Guy Mondo Brewing in London put together some brought over some English brewers, right?
Yeah, so Tom and Todd, the owners, came over, and they first brewed with, I believe, Keith and Captain Lawrence.
It was the same day, actually.
It was the same day. Yeah, and we tried to spread it around. It got a little IPA heavy. I think we did a smoothie IPA, right, with Captain Lawrence, a sour with Gun Hill, a red IPA with Harpoon, and then New England IPA, of course, with Night Shift. And we're really excited about it. It's kind of like the first time something like this has happened, especially with a sports angle. I think it's going to go over really well. I think everyone was texting after that the beers came out really well.
And Keith, how did you get involved in the project?
Yeah, so we were super excited about it. Q reached out to us. He told us what was going on. I met the Mondo guys previously down at Wakefest, and I had some of their beers previously. So really great guys over there. We're excited to be part of the project, the whole, you know, New York versus Boston. So we're ready to jump on board, and we decided to go in the direction of a blueberry smoothie to represent the blue for the Yankees. And it came out amazing.
So this is almost more of a Boston versus New York thing than it is
big time
anything. And Dave too, I know you're a baseball player.
Yeah, I mean, this was kind of a no-brainer for us to be tied with this. I mean, our brewery Gunhill started based on baseball because Kieran and I played on this baseball team together. That's how we met. So anything that we do that can be associated with baseball, we're all for. And in that same vein, we actually made a blueberry sour beer as well. So tying in with the New York blueberry and Yankees.
One of the connection. Best names.
Yeah, our beer is called Chillin' With My Booberry.
What do you think about this, Peter? I mean, you're getting creative and everything, but you got really solid roots in the beer industry. You know, you worked for distributors before.
I was really excited about the project. I'm a local guy too. I grew up a big fan of the Mets growing up, and you know, we started kind of talking about this opportunity of the Yankees and Red Sox playing over there for a long time. But I was really impressed by how Kirban started talking to all the people that we know that are also interested in this, and how it came together. And everybody, you know, they were super creative in how we put together the brews. Timelines worked out really well, and coordination and all those efforts, you know, it was hand in glove. Everybody really got on the same page really quickly. And now, you know, I was
good
part
one,
of
Kelly.
That's great. I've been in beer long enough to know when you couldn't get anything but, you know, pretty generic American style Pilsner at a baseball game. And that still has a place, right? I'll still have some of those, but it's been really nice over the last 10 years to see the different options that you have at ballparks, and to know that we're going to be a part of a project that has that same direct impact overseas for the first game between the Red Sox and the Yankees in London. It's super exciting. It's an opportunity we should all be really happy to be a part of.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, I mean, the way I see it is first, it's exciting that the Yankees and Red Sox are going to be playing in London. It seems that the English have an interest in all things American. They want barbecue, they want hot sauce, they want craft beer. But still, you know, your guys' background, it's still pretty interesting that you guys kind of took over this little niche of craft beer export. Tell us a little bit what it's been like the last couple of years, the breweries that you're working with regularly before the baseball project.
Oh, yeah. So what a year it's been since the last time we were on. You know, so Peter and I are coming up on year four. It'll be the end of July. I can't believe it's flown by that quickly. But you know, when we started, craft was becoming a thing overseas, and now, you know, you sometimes feel that it's as saturated over there as it is over here. And our mission was always get great beer tasting the same overseas as it does here, at a price point and approachability that it could really elevate craft beer to the next chapter overseas. And I think we've luckily been really successful at that. And you know, there's been a lot of other people that have helped us along the way. I think I would be remiss if I didn't mention that we brought on Andrew Reed end of last year to be our true head of sales. And he has been absolutely crushing for us, and actually the only one of us that's fully based overseas. And I don't know, for anyone who doesn't know, he was running craft sales team for Manhattan Beer. So he's a great New York City beer legend and understands the market really well, and understands the New York and U.S. market really well.
And his wife is from Sweden, right?
Right, exactly. So really jealous sometimes of the perks that he gets over there. We're really excited to see where this thing goes, and it seems to have no end in sight.
Well, that's great. Well, let's get Kelly involved in this too. So you mentioned earlier that part of the export process is there's different countries and different rules. Tell us about selling beer to Norway and Sweden. You mentioned a tender system.
Yeah, so it's funny, actually. When we had just started, Kelly was one of the first people that we talked to, obviously a titan in the New York beer scene. It was definitely, I remember being a little intimidated going to that meeting, but we submitted.
I have that effect on people.
Yeah. So the way that beer sales work in Scandinavia, Norway, and Sweden, to be specific, is that you have the on-premise, and it's very much similar to how beer is sold in the U.S. However, the off-premise is completely different.
It's like retail stores, grocery stores.
So for all beers, for Sweden, for all beers north of 3.5% to go into the state-run liquor stores called the Systembolaget, you have to win a blind taste test. Obviously, there's pricing parameters in there, but it really does come down to just a blind taste test, who has the best beer. And that has been something that's, I think, been a reason why craft has exploded specifically in Scandinavia. Norway's a similar model. Any beer over 4.7 has to go through the Vinmonopolet, which is their state-run liquor store. And there's some pros to it, like, you know, sitting next to Keith. Keith knows full well the successes we've had with Captain Lawrence Grapefruit winning the first citrus IPA tender in Sweden, and at its peak, it was the number two best-selling IPA in a can in the entire country, which is amazing. But then there's also downsides in that, in Norway for that Kelso Pils, we placed second, and that, you know, it probably came down to just one judge marking it a 9 instead of a 10, and then we're not in any of the stores with that beer. So it's a really interesting system if you know how to game it, if you know how to work with it, and then also you have great suppliers who are willing to work with you on it. And then also a great distribution partner overseas.
They were clearly not intimidated over there.
Not by you. But you guys, you know, the brewers here, Keith in particular, tell us about other exports that you've done, other you know, opportunities you've had.
Yeah, so to bring it back, I remember when Q was getting started and he came to us and kind of told of his plan and like, all right, let's give this a shot. Weren't really sure what to expect out of it. And so we started trickling some beer overseas and whatnot. And then as Q mentioned, you know, fast forward a little bit, we had applied for the citrus tender. We won this tender. So we're kind of excited and we're like, we don't really know what this means just yet until we started seeing the orders come in and come to realize that, you know, as Q mentioned, we were in, I believe at one point, almost every single liquor store in the country of Sweden. So you could find a Polar Bear and you could find Captain Lawrence Grapefruit. So it was pretty exciting at that time. And, the market was, you know, pretty, they're pretty, the Swedes are really excited about American craft and they support the culture and the brewers, good beer coming out. So, it's been a great success for us. We've kind of gone from 0 to 100 over there. But as Q mentions, there's pros and cons to all these, processes, and it's a little bit like the lottery, and, we were fortunate in that.
So how do you guys, when you think about your business plans for your breweries, how do you see exports? I mean, are they the same as trying to ship to another state? Do you think of them in that way?
We start to look at it a little bit differently. So, you know, we kind of look at Crafted as a distributor partner, and then from there it'll kind of branch out to a few different areas. So as that continues to grow and develop, we're going to have to kind of assess that and treat each of those markets a little bit differently.
Yeah. And Kelly, do you want to talk about that tender process from 5 years ago?
I think you pretty much hit on it. We submitted for a tender, and they said, no, you didn't finish first, so, you know, what are you going to do? You just try it again some other time, but, you know, it's an interesting thing trying to get into different markets overseas. Everybody's got their rules and the regulations. We just shipped a bunch of stuff to Japan late last year, I think it was. Gunhill was part of that as well. The shipping part was easy because there's somebody coordinating the whole thing. But on the back end, there was just a tremendous amount of follow-up questions. You need more documentation, you need more of this, more of that. So every market's got its own thing. And it's I never really thought I'd be exporting stuff. I sent beer to Pacific Northwest, where I'm from, and I thought that was plenty far. You know? Because when you start shipping like that, it starts to get really expensive, right? So you gotta start shipping quantity. And, you know, I'm from the Pacific Northwest, so I was going out there a couple times a year, so I figured I might as well write off my flight, you know. So
yeah. And Dave, what about you guys for Gunhill?
Yeah, I mean, for us, the idea of going overseas was never really part of our initial business plan. So when Q came to us, it was sort of the same thing. We were like, we'll give it a shot because we don't really see any downside to doing it because it wasn't part of our initial sort of focus. And now it's like it's starting to pick up a little bit more, I'd say, in the last 6 to 9 months for us specifically. And so, you know, we're able, just because of some of the policies that we've put in place at the brewery, we're able to sort of forecast out a little bit better than we were maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And that's enabled us, I think, to get a little bit more sort of leeway with these guys in terms and get more in there in front of them early, which allows us to get more overseas. But we don't view it as like a driver for us right now, just because our whole motto is the further you are away from home, the harder it is. And so, like, you know, we look up and down the East Coast, and even like going two states over, a 2.5 hour drive is challenging enough. So, you know, to be a long 6 hour plane ride away or even longer, it makes it more and more difficult.
Yeah. Hey, what beer are we drinking?
This is our Helles Lager called Spreadsheet Mafia that we did with the as part of the Locals to Locals. I think you've had Andrew Preston on.
Yeah, from Long Island.
Yeah.
It's great, great, great first beer. Let's pop a couple more beers too. And Keith, anything else about export situation? Things that are interesting to you?
You know, it's all very interesting because, you know, every single country or area is a little bit different, and you start to learn about the differences. You know, here you see, you know, price premiumization going on in the categories, and there in certain areas, the UK, for instance, is very price sensitive. You know, the way that the on-premises run is very interesting as well compared to the, you know, as Q mentioned, the system blogget and the government running all these things. Well, there you have some massive groups that run more or less the whole country. Here you have, in New York, you have a bar group that owns, you know, a dozen places. There, they own 300 restaurants. So to be able to get into that system is again, it's like very similar approach, I would guess, and Q could talk more on this, to, you know, winning the lottery, get in front of those guys, and then next thing you know, you're in 300 pubs throughout the UK.
Q?
Yeah, completely. We Peter and I were on a conference call earlier today, and we talked at length about how it's a symbiotic relationship between growing the off-premise and growing the on-premise. I think that's something that's been special about us, and Peter's been really focused on making sure that remains a really core part of our mission, to understand how important the on-premise is. You can sometimes get lost in the sales and opportunities in the off-premise, but it's all for naught if we don't keep that foothold in the on-premise.
So, and as you approach, you guys are almost like agents. So you're not just doing the shipping, you're actually out there getting the sales, connecting, and you're probably hand selecting certain beers, like Davey said, ahead of time. You know what's available. Just talk us through that process, because it sounds like what you're doing is pretty nichey. I don't see the big guys doing this. It seems like you're basically like agents and partners of these local craft breweries.
We're trying to approach the business in a way that makes sense for all the breweries, because they're at different stages in their growth. They have different strategic goals, but a lot of times we can come to them and say, we have some opportunities that your profile, your branding, your beers, your pricing, like all this would fit something that we think would really work well in market. And, you know, we said this earlier today. The first part of that conversation is we're really being interviewed on what kind of partners we can be. The distribution system here in the U.S., you know, that's a marriage a lot of times. So, you know, you have to be very careful in your partner selection. At the second step, we're then interviewing the breweries that we're working with. Can they deliver quality with regularity? Are they good partners to work with? Are they operationally efficient and flexible? All these things are really important if you want to be successful in distributing overseas. So we try to be really transparent about what the needs are and how to grow a business that way. But we don't just, like, you know, get it to the 1 yard line and expect, you know, the market to dictate it, or some, you know, distributor that we never see again to handle it. Like Keith said, we try to play an integrated role so that, you know, the time zone difference, the difference in languages, the compliance issues that you deal with in all these different places that Kelly touched on too, like, we want to be a centerpiece for all of that, to an inflection point. All that information can be consolidated so we can help all of our partners manage overseas, their main responsibility doesn't change, and that's what we're trying to do for the breweries. They brew and package beer, right? That's a fundamental cornerstone of what the brewing industry is. We don't want these guys to figure out like how to, you know, figure out compliance language in Sweden or know the intricacies of like two different state control distribution systems. That's what we're here for. So we go to them and we say, hey, there's a new tender in Norway. We think that you guys would be a good fit. Can you put some thought into it? Here are the parameters. And then we kick that to them. They do what they do and then come back to us.
No, I was going to say from our perspective, like I think literally the only difference besides the size of the kegs and the specific kegs that we're filling, like we have to put something different on the keg collar. But other than that, like it's really no different for us than dealing with any other distributor that we have when we're sending this beer out. Like, it, you know, I get a shipping label and that's pretty much it. We put it on the pallet and then it goes. And so from our perspective, these guys couldn't make it really any easier than they do when it comes to actually sending the product and once it goes over there.
That's the best compliment I think that we've ever gotten.
Let's toast to that.
Cheers.
Cheers, guys.
Because that's literally the business model, right? We want to make sure that we know, we talk about this all the time. I've worked supply side, distributor side here locally. And I wanted to make a lot of the headaches that I had go away. And it was because it was a different headache every day. I didn't remember how to ship to Brazil or, you know, to Connecticut, right? Like it was always like a different, you know, you have to do lab testing for one, you have to go through the Chamber of Commerce for another. And it's hard and it takes away a lot of focus from what you should be focusing on for the breweries. So the DNA is 95% the same, but the 5% that's different makes all of the difference, right? In terms of, you know, you can make a lot of analogies, but like if you aim at something that's like an inch away, you're going to be pretty accurate. But if you aim for something that's 300 yards away, if you're just a little bit off from the start, it's going to be way off target. So what we're trying to do is make sure that everybody can stay on target all the way.
What's through. The sport in Norway in the north where you have to ski and shoot in the same thing? Is that biathlon?
The biathlon, yeah.
You made a shooting reference. But yeah. What's the next beer we're drinking? Because we're going to take a break in a second.
This is called Buena Onda. It's our Mexican lager that we just released last week.
That seems like a popular style, doesn't it now? Mexican style lagers.
Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily have to just be around Cinco de Mayo anymore.
That's great. We're going to ask a couple more questions, but I'll tell you what, we're going to take a short break just for a little message. We'll be back in a minute on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Hey, thank you, Roberta's Pizza and Brandon Hoy. We really appreciate you guys sponsoring us and supporting HeritageRadioNetwork.org. All right, we're drinking the Gun Hill. What is it, Davey? The Buena Onda?
Yep,
Mexican lager. Seems like a really popular style. Seems like everybody wants a Mexican lager these days.
It's nice and clean and refreshing, so perfect for a day like today.
It's great. I mean, we were just talking a little bit more about some of the intricacies of exporting beer, differences between states and countries. But Peter and Q, give me examples like between like Sweden and England. Some things that are different, you know, that you have to, whether it's labeling or, you know, permitting?
So one thing that comes to mind, because we like this comes up in every conversation that we have with breweries, especially to start, people look for comps. Like, what does that country, like, what state is that country like? And we're finding out more and more that everything, just like every state is pretty unique, every country is also. I'll kick this to Q in a second, but one of the things between the two markets, the UK is much more like New York City, where it's 80-20 on-prem versus off-prem, and Sweden is the inverse of that, where 80% of the alcohol is consumed in the off-premise versus the on-premise. So we have like a very draft-heavy strategy because we also led with the UK, but we needed to evaluate how to focus on draft as a sampling opportunity in Sweden rather than the specific lead like we did in the UK.
So this is Kirban again. Differences in countries. So the UK, outside of being, as Peter mentioned, it's very draft oriented. Also, it's very price oriented in a way. Every place is price oriented, but it's a whole other level in the UK. If it's above a point, certain point, nobody will buy it. So you really have to come in at the right price. But the UK, as like a pro to it, very little work from a compliance perspective. Launching new beers is very easy. The paperwork is very minimal. Then you have Scandinavia, which is the complete opposite. The pricing is important, but the elasticity seems to go a little bit further there. But the compliance is a nightmare. You know, if we want to bring in two kegs of something, it's sometimes like, oh my God, this is like hours of work just to get two kegs into the country. And then they're very specific about what they let in. Norway, you can literally, they're very tough on branding. So if it's too on the nose, they just won't allow it in. And that goes also to the effect of like POS. You can't have bar mats or coasters or anything that really advertises the beer, which is funny, but that's the way the market runs. So it really just comes down to the liquid. Sweden is also a little bit crazy. Like I remember when we first sent over cans of Hop Commander, there's a hop, it's a caricature. And they were like, it's driving a car that you're promoting drunk driving. And so we had to fight that. And then also when it came down to grapefruit tender, in that same hop is holding a knife cutting a grapefruit, and we had to actually remove that and run a whole new can to get that out. And then I remember with Butternut's War Dance, they collaborated with Anthrax, and that was a whole uphill
the
battle
band
explaining
Anthrax,
to, that was a whole that was a whole battle explaining to them that that was a band and exactly. So there's nuances and differences in each market into how branding needs to be, how pricing needs to be, and then there's pros and cons to everyone.
Peter?
Yeah, anybody who's been through the naming process with the TTB for approval knows that like it can be threading a needle sometimes, and having had approval here, specifically the Anthrax War Dance, was like mind-numbing, the number of conversations that we had to have. We finally got there, but it, like, you know, something that was a huge uphill battle here, it was just as hard to then replicate it overseas, regardless of the fact that it happened here. So we continually like learn new things and new challenges about the market. But again, we're trying to head those off to streamline it so that we can get everybody to concentrate on what they're good at.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to just digress a little bit. So Kelly Taylor, one of the OG brewers.
I like that introduction. I'm going to digress. Kelly.
Yeah, digress. OG brewers, you know, we know you. Kelso, you brewed for Heartland Brewery, Greenpoint Beer Works forever. So many brewers that work in the city now worked with you. Guys like Chris Kuzme, Fifth Hammer, was working with you. Just want to give a big shout-out to Kelly. Just to say, just how far craft beer's come, that not too long ago, he was one of four breweries in the city.
For sure.
And now there's over 30, and we're talking about...
There's over 45.
Over 45, wow. Yeah. And we're talking about exporting to Sweden and England. But Kelly, I just want to say, just give us a shout-out. So right now, you're looking to open a brewery up in Westchester. Just give us a quick rundown of what you're doing.
Well, we lost our lease a few years ago, and we've been looking for a space. And you know, price of real estate's gone up. Competition has doubled. The amount of breweries within the city, not to mention the breweries coming from outside the city. That's one of the great things about New York City, right? I've always promoted that, and is that not only do we have a lot of great locally made beer, but we also have a lot of beer that is made from around the world coming in here. People will produce beer and sell it in their home market and send it to New York City because it goes like that. So, which is great from a consumer standpoint. It's a little tricky from a craft brewer standpoint. So we've been kind of watching the market and seeing how it's going, and we really want to rebuild a local brewery. You know, that was our big thing. You know, over a decade in Clinton Hill, we were local. It was all focused on local and getting the freshest beer possible to the market and engaging with the consumers in our neighborhoods. Captain Lawrence, you know, that's how you guys started, right? It's all local, local, local. So we're going to go up and try to take some of Captain Lawrence's market.
Easy, Kelly.
Well, you know, but, you know, the market is growing, though, right? You know, yeah. So the pie is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so the amount of space that we originally thought we wanted couple years ago when we lost our lease, the amount of space is starting to shrink a little bit. And I bet you Scotty would wish his space was a little bit smaller up there at this point. You know, but I mean,
not after doubling it.
Yeah. Well, right. But a lot of that's the tap room driven, I would assume.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. So that's a big part of it. So the tap room starts to become a bigger and bigger part of what our projection is going to be, and less of the distribution side of the model. So we're looking at that now, and we're raising money. We're about a third of the way there with our fundraise. Every time we shrink the projections and try to do more of the taproom thing, it becomes more and more of a restaurant brewery versus a distribution brewery. And then you go back to the investors. There's a really interesting part of the market that I don't really know anything about, which is funny because I've been brewing for over 25 years. But you know, I'm learning this whole project and learning how the investment part works. And, you know, we're just plugging along.
That's great. Well, it's great to have you back on. We just wanted to let you get a little shout out there about that. And let's go back. So, Gun Hill, man, same kind of story. I've known you guys a long time since you started. We had you on. You did a Broadway Brews project.
Yep.
With the cast of Hamilton.
3 years ago already.
Made a beer.
Yeah.
What's up with you guys now? You've opened a second tasting location.
Yep. So we have Gun Hill Tavern, which is in the South Bronx now. So it's under our farm license. And we have eight of our beers on tap, some local cider, and also local New York spirits there. And then we have a small kitchen. So it's sort of, you know, one of our biggest things was the Bronx was always sort of the unknown frontier. And when we opened our brewery in the North Bronx, it was very clear that there was no good way for people from other boroughs and also from the South Bronx to get to our brewery by public transportation. So we felt that by opening something in the South Bronx, we would be able to get the traffic that was not coming on a regular basis. So now we have another spot that is a local spot and is much more accessible. Like, it's 30 minutes to Midtown Manhattan on the train. It's across the street from the 6 train, around the corner from the 4-5. Whereas going to the brewery, even from Midtown Manhattan, you're looking at an hour plus, hour and a half on the train. So that's sort of the most recent thing for us.
Great. And Keith, my names are all over the place today, but Scott Vaccaro, Captain Lawrence, founder, brewer. How's he doing?
He's doing great. He's always got something going on. As Kelly alluded to a little bit earlier, we just went through another expansion for the tasting room. So another 5,000 square feet over there. Distillery soon to come. So very exciting times. You know, our strategy is we were, you know, very local as well for many years. And then it came to the point where we started, you know, expanding, and it pretty much looked like one market per year. And it's been a great strategy for us. The last year was amazing, and we're on pace for another great year.
Great. And where else, what are the strongest markets you have? You're selling in New York?
New York's a great market. The greater Philly area is a great market. D.C.'s been fantastic. We're doing good up in Massachusetts. And then we recently, the Carolinas have been great. And we recently launched Florida, and they're off to a great start as well.
You know,
obviously, we talked about the export.
And separate from export, you know, I'm noticing that a lot more like traditional restaurants, that some of them have been around for a while, are starting to consider adding more craft beer. Like maybe you have six lines of beer. You might see them being open to doing this. I guess what I'm saying is, Keith, I've got a restaurant on the Upper West Side I'm working with. The guy's interested in trying out some craft beer, but doesn't really know it. What would you pitch as like the first beer someone should take on if they're just adding craft beer? And it's, we're kind of going backwards. I feel like we did this 12, 15 years ago, but it's amazing that we're talking about the industry and the growth. We know that there's this much money being spent on beer. It's probably not going to grow, but the craft has potential to grow.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky question, right? The industry has changed so fast over the years, and specifically in the most recent years, that the change of what the consumer wants is nobody knows what it is. So you got to be able, you know, we're fortunate enough to be, while we're a decent sized regional brewery, we're small enough to be able to pivot and, you know, create new trends and jump on new trends and see what's out there. So if somebody's opening up, you know, we have a wide enough portfolio to find a hole in whatever you're looking for with that draft line. And I think that's the best strategy to approach. You know, if you already have a great pills online and a, you know, IPA online, well, we're going to go in a different direction and vice versa. So I think the strategy is, you know, nowadays it's kind of giving the consumer what they want and making you sure you fit well into that tap line.
Yeah, let's say you had, I mean, there's so many restaurants in New York that fit this. They've got a Stella on, they've got a Guinness, you know, they've got another macro-owned, you know, crafty brand. And there's one line that's open. Pick a beer. What would you suggest?
I would say Stella and Guinness are both open, incidentally.
let's say they're not.
No,
ready
I mean, realistically.
For that.
I mean, that's because yeah. If you go in with a craft nitro Irish stout, a lot of places are looking for something different. You know, so they're like, oh, you have a local nitro stout? Nobody else has got it. You know, or you go in and they have Stella, and you're like, you know, try this. It tastes the same. You know, it's very similar, but you can take it off, and I have, and I think that's the thing that you're kind of battling. Is a lot of people don't think you can take it off, but you can.
I mean, we did this in 2005. People asked for Stella. I had a Belgian Pils, but you know now it's like I think the bigger market is that there's more mainstream restaurants that want to take on some lines.
Well, I think it depends on two things. Number one is what are they willing to spend on the beer? Like if they're trying to get you to compete with certain price points, well, that's a different conversation. And then the second thing is, do they want something that is always going to be available, or are they willing to rotate? Because if you're only looking to rotate, then you open yourself up to a much larger audience. But if you're looking to just focus on having a dedicated line or a dedicated style, then you're sort of narrowing your focus a bit more and narrowing who you're going to talk to. Because in this day and age, a lot of these breweries that are opening up, they don't have flagship beers. And if they do, they're probably only making flagship IPAs. So if you're not going after an IPA or a Pilsner line, then you're looking at a much smaller group of breweries to talk about that free line.
Keith?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. You know, so number one, right, I'm always going to go after the IPA line and or the Pilsner line. And the two highest volume lines out there, without a doubt. And then there becomes the subcategories. Okay, you're looking for something different for an IPA. Well, we got a grapefruit IPA. We have a New England-style IPA. We have a junior New England-style IPA. Or you're looking for, you know, something that's a special release. We have smoothie beers. So you got to have to have that flexibility within your portfolio to be able to find that, you know, that place in each and every bar out there looking for something.
And then bringing this to export into England and Sweden, what changes happened over there? Because it you know it's not overnight, but there's definitely an interest in having American craft beer in those countries.
The conversation resonates with us because craft beer, while growing and very quickly overseas, one of the things that we're challenged with is like, how do we get to that next level account? Right now, a lot of the craft beer scene is kind of in those high spotting accounts where it's specifically driven to be a craft beer bar. And what we're trying to do from a value proposition and for our own company's growth is get into those bars where like Sierra Nevada was like an early adapter in those bars where it was a bunch of macro beers and then a secondary option for volume. So what we're trying to do too is always work with our breweries to say, same conundrum, right? There's a Carling, a Carlsberg, Foster's, and a Guinness line. What can we get in there? And how does that prove or provide value to the beer buyer, the owner of the establishment? And a lot of times it's going to be its perception, right? And that's driven by volume. How often are they changing kegs? How often do they have to order it? They're not running a P&L by draft line, you know? So you might know that you're providing like higher revenue or stuff like that, but it's not always going to speak to that. And it goes back to, hand-to-hand combat, right? You're in the account, you're showing your face, you're providing the staff with the tools that they need to sell beer. It's equally as important as the style that you choose to be in there. And then it has to actually translate to actually working with the customer. So we're constantly doing that here. It's less competitive, but in a different way. Like in the UK, those second level accounts don't have, I cut my teeth on the supplier side at Six Point, and it was great, you know, on Smith Street, where you had all these bars where there were a lot of macro lagers for a long time that just started integrating and carrying the Bengali Tiger and stuff like that. It's having that conversation where you can flip that one line where it's a permanent fixture of it, and we're still looking for, there's no magic bullet, right? It's account by account. You're gonna have to try to figure out
how talk to the bar manager and you get the beer in, right? That's, you get it into the draft rotation, and then you go and you have a tasting with the whole staff, including the kitchen. And if you get the kitchen guys involved, and they start, because they'll start drinking the beer, and all of a sudden you start going through a lot of kegs. They're not running the numbers being like, oh, look how much of this beer we sold. They're looking at the empty keg, and they're saying, oh, we need to order some more of this keg. So they'd go through a lot of beer. Like, yeah, this is really moving quickly. But then the kitchen staff was drinking half of it. So that's to your point, is that sometimes they're not actually running the numbers. They're looking at how much of the beer they're changing
They do it by feel.
Yeah, so yeah. A lot of it, you know. It's cute.
Yeah, and there's one more thing. You know, Peter hit it with talking about, that's the world we're kind of living in, where there's a lot of those bars overseas. They are new to this whole world, and they are asking us that question. There's also the other side of export, which is a lot of these countries, you can actually just buy draft lines. So it's working.
But you can't do that in the city, though.
New York, no, that doesn't happen at all here, does it? Right, but overseas, I'm just bringing the parallel to the international point and to the national world. And these are very above table handshake contracts where we can actually go in and say we have to find the right places that we want to actually establish, and then we work with our distribution partner to find those places, and then we can actually buy those draft lines. And then that's also a great place to be, because then you can find a world where you're the only craft line, and that's when you're pretty dangerous, as Peter was alluding to.
Now let's go back to the baseball collaborations, because that's kind of why you brought in Captain Lawrence and Gunhill. So you put that together. So Mondo Brewing, they're an American guy that has a beer operation in London.
They're two amazing American guys that worked in the UK beer scene, also worked other parts of the world, but they started a brewery in 2015, which by London standards is light years ago. I mean, when we first started the company in 2014, there were probably like 30 craft breweries, and we think of how saturated New York is as the marker being, 45? London is a similar sized city with 180. So it's a whole different world, but they're doing some really great things. They benefit from being American in that they can look, they travel here quite often. They know what's going on here. They have phenomenal connections in the beer space. And we're very like-minded in our crafted approaches and their approach to, sales and brewing. So we get along really well. And, it's no shock that I spent a lot of my time at their tap room when I was living in London, earlier this year. And, they kind of recognize how important the MLB series is going to be, because it's not just going to be this year, right? It's going to be years to go.
Is that Major League Baseball? Is that what you said?
You just mean Yankees Red Sox.
Yankees Red Sox, yeah. And Peter, having spent substantial time in both Boston and in New York, this was really a no-brainer series for us to highlight both cities. And they're also probably, you know, two of the top cities for us in terms of where our supplier representation is. So it's been great to be able to highlight those. I can't wait to get over there in June and drink those beers.
So right now, the Gunhill and the Captain Lawrence beers, they're on a boat going over to England?
Yeah. So, you know, Peter is the best of the best at making sure the beer is tasting phenomenal and gets there in a very speedy time that the customer is always very happy with. And they're currently on their way. And I think they're going to,
let's talk about the kegs. So what are they? Are they one-way kegs? Are they plastic kegs? Are they metal kegs? What's the technology that you're using? Because now you've been doing it for a few years.
We have a partner that we work with that allows for a lot of flexibility, but we use 30-liter Frankie German-manufactured steel kegs. They have an S-type coupler, so they're fairly easy to fill at your standard brewery. But they, you know, this is like the Kleenex of kegs. They guarantee a good amount of, you know, there's a significant quality guarantee when using.
Did you just say Kleenex of kegs?
Kind of, yeah.
Okay.
I did.
You might want to rethink that.
I'm sticking with it, Kelly. I don't know.
Okay, Kleenex of kegs? Come on.
Well, I mean, like, it's Frankie, in my mind, in operations, has always been the standard in terms of guaranteeing quality for, you know, what you're going to put your product in, right?
This is shipping to England, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Rolls Royce of kegs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Right.
First one's free.
That got a little intimidating there for a second.
I'm just really giving you crap is what I'm doing.
No, and I enjoy it.
It's a Kleenex of kegs. Come on.
Yeah.
But one-way kegs.
Analogy. I didn't think I was going to
get called
about
what? It.
Yeah.
It's cold chain.
No, I understand.
It's cold chain shipping the whole way?
Yeah, cold chain shipping. So one of the things we have like a large integrated partnership with all of our breweries. So what we do is we ship everything refrigerated, we consolidate it, but we often ask like our brewing partners to hold on and warehouse the kegs for a couple of days until it gets picked up, refrigerated, freight, and then it gets right into cold storage on the other side. So like what we are often have, or more likely have, the beer that's being consumed that we ship overseas is fresher than you're going to find it in a lot of local establishments, or if you get an order from Fresh Direct. The beer that you drink that we're picking up from the breweries and how we manage it is often going to be fresher than what you can get through regular retail. So, you know, Kirban did a really good job strategizing and focusing on the collaboration, making sure everybody was communicating with each other and setting up dates. But I'm hammering him every day. When is this going to be packaged? When is it going to be ready? What date does it have to be there? Because all of that is equally as important. You can make a great beer, but if it's not there at the right time, if it doesn't taste right, if it's not at the same, you know, pricing component, you know, the important aspects and cornerstones of logistics, then, you know, it's a vanity project.
So, Keith, the beer you made for England, just tell me a couple steps that happened and what you had to do.
Yeah, so in regards to the, you know, collaboration process, obviously there's a lot of back and forth about, you know, what we want to do stylistically for the recipe, and that's where the kind of brewers take over that wheelhouse. But a couple points that these guys have mentioned, you know, just now and earlier today is that, you know, the one thing that we had those original discussions about working with Crafted was we weren't willing to compromise any of the quality, right, which nobody in this room would either. And they kind of assured us of all these processes and this and that. And I was fortunate enough to take a couple trips over there and to see, I mean, it's accurate. I mean, we've done some freshest programs over there trying to get it out of our docks to their stores as soon as possible. And they've really been able to deliver on those promises, which is extremely important to us because you don't know. The boards that's going on a boat overseas, and when you get there and you crack that beer, you want it to taste exactly as it does here, or what's the point? You're not representing your product as it's intended to be represented. So it's been a great process to making that happen.
Well, I want to thank you guys for giving me a little insight into this other world of craft beer and exports. The last beers we had, Kelly, what beer did you bring? You brought in a little ball jar.
Yeah, it was a collaboration kind of pilot batch I did with Queens Brewery. It's a Belgian Session Brut IPA. So we just kind of tried to get all the catchphrases.
Queensbury, he's finally opened a location in Queens.
Yeah, he's got a small pilot system going over in Ridgewood, and I've been down there helping him put that together and put the main system together. And I've been brewing on the pilot system, just doing kind of random one off stuff, which has been fun putting like the boots on again and going down and, you know, actually crushing the malt and getting the whole thing together and and being able to throw whatever we want at it. I mean, playing with the enzymes that you need to do a brewed IPA with a Belgian yeast and different kinds of hops from Croatia has been really interesting.
Right. And is there one last beer we're going to taste?
Yeah, we have our American Amber called Broadway Boogie.
Let's pop that, Davey. And I just want to thank everyone for joining me. We got Kelly Taylor. Everyone, just say their name and sign off for me, please.
Kelly Taylor, sign off.
Dave Lopez.
Sign off.
Keith Feckety, sign off. Thank you, Jimmy.
Kerbon Walia, signing off.
Peter McNulty, signing off.
All right, guys. I guess that means we can say goodnight. Thank you, engineer Matt Patterson, producer Justin Kennedy. I'm Jimmy Carbone, the host here. Thanks for joining us on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Cheers.
Thank you, Jimmy. Woo.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebrations happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends. And please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.